You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, make sure you have pen and paper handy. We are going to continue today with our reading of the report entitled The Right to Keep and Bear Arms, which is the report of the Subcommittee on the Constitution of the Committee on the Judiciary, United States Senate, 97th Congress, Second Session, February 1982. Printed for the use of the Committee on the Judiciary by the United States Government Printing Office. It is for sale by the Superintendent of Documents, United States Government Printing Office, Washington, D.C., 20402. If you would, and you should, like to obtain a copy. Don't go away. I'll be right back, and we'll pick up right where we left off yesterday. Does that make your blood boil? Well, it should. A lot of people call, some write, they want to know, Bill, what's all that Nazi stuff in your music? Why does it sound like Hitler's coming back? Because he is, folks. You see, the Nazis, the socialists, and the communists have spent many, many years turning right into wrong and wrong into right. And they've pulled the wool so far down over your eyes that you don't even know it's there, for the most part, but it is. They want you to think that our founding fathers were extreme right-wing radical maniacs. Our founding fathers were liberals, ladies and gentlemen. And their principles and ideals upon which they founded this great nation were all liberal principles and ideals. That's the truth. Whether you want to believe it or not, it's the truth. So not only are patriots and militia members and real Americans who adhere to those principles and ideals not extreme right wing, they're not even close to being in the camp with Hitler or all of those people. You see, the people who are in charge now and who are destroying this nation from within, and literally every nation on the face of this earth, are socialists. Devout socialists, I might add. And they want you to believe that Hitler was somehow extreme right-wing somewhere in the camp with the founding fathers. And it's just not true. It won't wash at all. You see, Hitler was a socialist. Nazi literally means National Socialist German Workers' Party. That's what it means. Hitler socialized Germany. Oh yeah, it's true. And that's what Clinton wants to do. And that's why things in this country are beginning to look more and more like Nazi Germany all the time. And if they have their way, oh yes, all the stuff that Hitler did is going to be repeated in spades. And you're all going to wonder, what happened? Because while you weren't looking, they convinced you that all that stuff is right and you should be looking forward to it. And all of the things that our founding fathers did to set us free and take the yoke of enslavement off of us is somehow bad. It was the crowning achievement of all human history. They want to take you back and make you slaves again. There's no difference, ladies and gentlemen, between being chained to a computer or chained to a tree. No difference whatsoever. You're chained. Well, enough of that. For those of you who wondered about the music, that's the reason. And maybe sometime next week I'll explain that in much further detail. But now let's continue with our report. The right to keep and bear arms. And here we go. The Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, therefore, is a right of the individual citizen to privately possess and carry in a peaceful manner firearms and similar arms. Such an individual rights interpretation is in full accord with the history of the right to keep and bear arms, as we have previously discussed. It is, moreover, in accord with contemporaneous statements and formulations of the right by such founders of this nation as Thomas Jefferson and Samuel Adams, and accurately reflects the majority of the proposals which led up to the Bill of Rights itself. A number of state constitutions adopted prior to or contemporaneously with the Federal Constitution and Bill of Rights similarly provided for a right of the people to keep and bear arms. If, in fact, this language creates a right protecting the states only, there might be a reason for it to be inserted in the Federal Constitution, but no reason for it to be inserted in state constitutions. State bills of rights necessarily protect only against action by the state, And by definition, a state cannot infringe its own rights. To attempt to protect a right belonging to the state by inserting in it a limitation of the state's own powers would create an absurdity. The fact that the contemporaries of the framers did insert these words into several state constitutions would indicate clearly that they viewed the right as belonging to the individual citizen, thereby making it a right which could be infringed either by state or federal government, and which must be protected against infringement by both. And that, of course, was the intent of the second article in amendment, to give the people a power greater than that possessed by the state. Finally, the individual rights interpretation gives full meaning to the words chosen by the first Congress to reflect the right to keep and bear arms. The framers of the Bill of Rights consistently use the words right of the people to reflect individual rights, as when these words were used to recognize the right of the people to peaceably assemble, and the right of the people against unreasonable searches and seizures. They distinguished between the rights of the people and of the state in the Tenth Amendment. As discussed earlier, the militia itself referred to a concept of a universally armed people, not to any specifically organized unit. When the framers referred to the equivalent of our National Guard, they uniformly used the term select militia and distinguished this from militia. Indeed, the debates over the Constitution constantly referred to organized militia units as a threat to freedom comparable to that of a standing army, and stressed that such organized units did not constitute, and indeed were philosophically opposed to, the concept of a militia. That the National Guard is not the militia referred to in the Second Amendment is even clearer today. You see, Congress has organized the National Guard under its power to raise and support armies, and not its power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. This Congress chose to do in the interests of organizing reserve military units which were not limited in deployment by the structures of our power over the constitutional militia, which can be called forth only, quote, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, end quote. The modern National Guard was specifically intended to avoid status as the constitutional militia, a distinction recognized by 10 United States Code, Section 311, small a. The conclusion is thus inescapable that the history, concept, and wording of the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, as well as its interpretation by every major commentator and court in the first half century after its ratification, indicates that what is protected as an individual right of a private citizen to own and carry firearms in a peaceful manner. And here is the case law, ladies and gentlemen. The United States Supreme Court has only three times commented upon the meaning of the Second Amendment to our Constitution. The first comment in Dred Scott indicated strongly that the right to keep and bear arms was an individual right. The court noted that were it to hold free blacks to be entitled to equality of citizenship, they would be entitled to keep and carry arms wherever they went. The second, in Miller, indicated that a court cannot take judicial notice that a short-barreled shotgun is covered by the Second Amendment, but the court did not indicate that National Guard status is any way required for protection by that amendment, and indeed defined militia to include all citizens able to bear arms. The third, a footnote in Lewis v. United States, indicated only that these legislative restrictions on the use of firearms, a ban on possession by felons, were permissible. But since felons may constitutionally be deprived of many of the rights of citizens, including that of voting, this dicta reveals little. These three comments constitute all significant explanations of the scope of the Second Amendment advanced by our Supreme Court. The case of Adam versus Williams has been cited as contrary to the principle that the Second Amendment is an individual right. In fact, that reading of the opinion comes only in Justice Douglas's dissent from the majority ruling of the court, and in no way constitutes a ruling of the Supreme Court. The appendix which follows represents a listing of 21 American decisions spanning the period from 1921, which have analyzed right to keep and bear arms provisions in the light of statutes ranging from complete bans on handgun sales to bans on carrying of weapons to regulation of carrying by permit systems. Those decisions not only explained the nature of such a right, but also struck down legislative restrictions as violative of it and are designated by asterisks. And I'm not going to read all of those, folks. If you get the report, you can read them for yourself, because it's a long list of things that most of you will not understand. And just to give you an indication of what I'm talking about, here's what it sounds like. Okay? It sounds like Jennings versus State, 5 Texas, Crim, App, 298 at 300-01, 1878. And then it gives a brief quote of what the judges said. Quote, "We believe that portion of the Act which provides that in case of conviction, the defendant shall forfeit to the county the weapon or weapons so found on or about his person is not within the scope of legislative authority. One of his most sacred rights is that of having arms for his own defense and that of the state. This right is one of the surest safeguards of liberty and self-preservation." And they're all exactly in that vein. Now for the last portion of the report, if I can find it. Here we go. Coming up. This is a portion of the report, the last portion, I might add. And by the way, for those of you who did not, who don't know what we're doing, let me cite it to you once again. I am reading directly from a report of the United States Senate entitled The Right to Keep and Bear Arms. It's a report of the Subcommittee on the Constitution of the Committee on the Judiciary, United States Senate, 97th Congress, Second Session, February 1982, printed for the use of the Committee on the Judiciary by the United States Government Printing Office. You can obtain this report. It is for sale by the Superintendent of Documents, United States Government Printing Office, Washington, D.C., 20402. And that is the address, folks. You don't need a street. The post office in Washington, D.C. knows exactly where that office is. And what you need to do is write them a polite letter, ask them if they still have the report in print, and tell them you would like to have a copy. Please send you the method by which you can obtain it. Anyway, here's the last portion of the report. It's entitled Enforcement of Federal Firearms Laws from the Perspective of the Second Amendment. Federal involvement in firearms possession and transfer was not significant prior to 1934, when the National Firearms Act was adopted. The National Firearms Act, as adopted, covered only fully automatic weapons, machine guns and submachine guns, and rifles and shotguns whose barrel length or overall length fell below certain limits. Not above, but below certain limits. Since the Act was adopted under the revenue power, sale of these firearms was not made subject to a ban or permit system. Instead, each transfer was made subject to a $200 excise tax, which must be paid prior to transfer. The identification of the parties to the transfer indirectly accomplished a registration purpose. The 1934 Act was followed by the Federal Firearms Act of 1938, which placed some limitations upon sale of ordinary firearms. Persons engaged in the business of selling those firearms in interstate commerce were required to obtain a federal firearms license at an annual cost of $1, and to maintain records of the name and address of persons to whom they sold firearms. Sales to persons convicted of violent felonies were prohibited, as were interstate shipments to persons who lacked the permits required by the law of their state. And ladies and gentlemen, I have just given you the entire jurisdiction and authority of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Their authority is only over first sale of a weapon brought into the country from abroad, or over sales of weapons in interstate commerce. Which means if a weapon is made in the state of Missouri, for instance, and it stays in the state of Missouri and is sold to a private citizen in the state of Missouri, according to the limitations of the Constitution for the United States of America, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has absolutely no authority, jurisdiction, or business whatsoever with that sale. The same thing goes for a weapon that is transferred interstate and has been duly authorized as a sale through two licensed interstate commerce firearms dealers. Once it is in the state at its final destination, whoever it is sold to within that state as an intrastate sale is strictly outside of the jurisdiction and authority of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Regardless of what they say, they are operating under the color of law outside of their jurisdiction and authority as prescribed by the Constitution for the United States of America, which is the supreme law of the land. Virtually every government agency in existence today is operating unconstitutionally as an outlaw agency against the supreme law of the land. They are slowly but surely stripping us of all of our rights. And when that process has been completed, you will find yourself once again in chains. You may not be able to see the chains, ladies and gentlemen. I guarantee you a lot of people will. And there are a lot of people right now who feel those chains, who have them on them literally. But you will nevertheless be chained. And you will know it, without any doubt whatsoever. Now let me continue with the last of the report. 30 years after adoption of the Federal Firearms Act, the Gun Control Act of 1968 worked a major revision of federal law. The Gun Control Act was actually a composite of two statutes. The first of these, adopted as portions of the Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act, imposed limitations upon imported firearms, expanded the requirement of dealer licensing to cover anyone engaged in the business of dealing in firearms, whether in interstate or local commerce, and expanded the record-keeping obligations for dealers. It also imposed a variety of direct limitations upon sales of handguns. No transfers were to be permitted between residents of different states unless the recipient was a federally licensed dealer, even where the transfer was by gift rather than the sale, and even where the recipient was subject to no state law which could have been evaded. The category of persons to whom dealers could not sell was expanded to cover persons convicted of any felony, other than certain business-related felonies, such as antitrust violations, persons subject to a mental commitment order or finding of mental incompetence, persons who were users of marijuana and other drugs, and a number of other categories. Another title of the Act defined persons who were banned from possessing firearms. Paradoxically, these classes were not identical with the list of classes prohibited from purchasing or receiving firearms. And in effect, the entire Gun Control Act of 1968 was unconstitutional, for the federal government has no authority to regulate anything, period, except just a few enumerated items which they are given power to regulate within the Constitution, such as counterfeiting, and just a very few other things, but nothing else, ladies and gentlemen. Their authority stops when interstate commerce stops. Their authority is only concerned with, and their jurisdiction lies only with, interstate or international commerce. That's why this radio station is broadcasting. It is an intrastate, that means within the state, non-commercial station. If you hear commercials on this station, they're old, what are called collector's commercials, and they're played strictly for your entertainment. They're not played to sell you anything whatsoever. And everybody who listens to this station knows it. It is a non-profit community service station. We are not paid for any commercials. We do not run any commercials. What you may hear that sounds like commercials are old collector's items played for your amusement and entertainment. Nobody pays us to play them. We don't have any interest in anything. We don't pay for programming. We don't get payment for programming. This station is completely operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a charity. It is a charitable trust established by my family in order to give back to the community and to the nation that which we have received. If every citizen did that, this would be a much better country, I can guarantee you. It's not our contribution. It's just one small portion of a whole lot of contributions that we make as a family. Now, if you doubt that, read the Constitution for the United States of America. It is the supreme law of the land, ladies and gentlemen. The federal government cannot, by law, exceed the limitations of that document. Nor can it seize, obtain, or use powers not granted to it by that document. And anything not specifically granted to the federal government in the Constitution for the United States of America, nor prohibited by the Constitution for the United States of America, is retained by the state and by the people. If the state fails to utilize that power or to prohibit it from the people, then all of those powers rest solidly in the hands of the individual people of the United States of America. I hope you'll all take me up on it. Just in a couple of weeks, we're going to start reading and studying the Constitution on the air. And I hope you're ready for that, because that's really going to open your eyes. You see, if the government is defined within that document and limited by the restrictions of the document and limited to only those powers given to the federal government by the document, when we get into this document, known as the Constitution for the United States of America, those of you who have never read it or studied it before are going to be aghast. Aghast. At the tyranny that is taking place. At the oppressiveness that the federal government has placed across the shoulders of the American people. At the unlawful, unconstitutional, and outlaw acts that they are performing across this country. And the manner in which they have convinced many of you who are listening to actually commit those unlawful, unconstitutional, and outlaw acts for them.